The 50s are usually thought of as a staid, benign decade defined by hula hoops and Ozzie and Harriet, and the president who presided over them, Dwight D. Eisenhower, is often remembered as something of a lightweight, a retired general with a fatherly smile and a penchant for playing golf. He was respected as a military figure, but less so as the president. Evan Thomas's new book, Ike's Bluff, reveals the 50s as a decade of delicate negotiating and political crisis where nothing less than the fate of the world was at stake, and Eisenhower as the subtle thinker and brilliant tactician who steered us through it safely. It's published by Little Brown. I'm very pleased it brings Evan Thomas to our show today. Hello.
Good morning.
Have all the previous biographies of Eisenhower tended to shortchange him as president?
No. There's a funny split. I mean, amongst a lot of people I run into, they still think of Eisenhower as his goofy grandfather. But there have been a bunch of books. Scholars have known for 30 years at least that Eisenhower was a clever, manipulative, even devious guy. So people who read this closely and know the history have known this for a long time. But the public image has remained of the grandfatherly golf player.
Well, we thought about this just a couple of weeks ago when Tom Ricks was on the show. He's written a book about the generals, and he points out that General Marshall chose Eisenhower to be the supreme commander during World War II over Patton, who had seniority, because he thought that Eisenhower was the smartest man and most capable to do the job.
Well, Eisenhower said he got ahead by disguising his intelligence and his ambition. The way he did it was by being underestimated. I mean, that was his brilliance in a way. And he studied at the foot of a master in teaching you how to be low-key, General Douglas MacArthur. Eisenhower was MacArthur's chief of staff in the 1930s, and he learned what not to do by watching MacArthur, by seeing a blowhard in action.
Is it fair to say, both from the point of view of his colleagues and staff and from the point of view of his biographers, that Ike was not easy to get to know?
Whoa, Ike had, as many great men do, many his house had many rooms. And there was the affable, sunny, warm, likable Ike, and you could know him on that level, but there were many other levels.
Well, isn't it true that even Mamie at one point was moved to comment on his reserve?
Yeah. Mamie said that she didn't know her husband all that well. That's a pretty strong statement from a woman who was married to the guy for over 60 years. And his son, John, I spent a lot of time with John Eisenhower, who's a wonderful guy. He's now 90 years old. And John said to me right off, you know, I don't really know my father that well. But he was willing to engage in this interesting sort of exploration of his father.
Did he have a small group of confidants, or did he pretty much keep everything close to the vest?
You know, he had people he played golf with and bridge with. But did he really share, I mean, with his brother Milton maybe? But Mamie, his wife, he was, you know, he had a loving marriage. And
Although he did have extramarital affairs.
Even on that, I mean, on the famous Kay Summersby thing, which people know about, it's unclear how intimate that relationship really was. But here's a little-known historical fact. Dwight Eisenhower was the first president to sleep in the same bed with his wife. At least modern president. They slept in a big double bed and had a loving, I think, and physical relationship despite whatever infidelities he may have engaged in.
Did he leave a large written record?
Yes, but it's a little – he's a military guy. They keep records, right? So the White House out in Abilene at the Presidential Library, they're fantastic records of the planning process. That's a little different from his most intimate thoughts, however. And his large memoirs are an exercise in deflection and disinformation by and large.
Now, you use the word planning, and here he is. Many people consider him the greatest hero in the greatest war ever, and he never saw combat. It was all about tactics?
Well, his famous line from the Elder von Moltke, was the Prussian chief of staff, which is that planning is everything, but plans are nothing, meaning that you got to plan, but once the war starts, planning goes out the window. So, yes, he had this elaborate planning process, but that doesn't mean he followed his own plans. He relied very much on his own gut and his own intuition.
And why, as a Supreme Allied Commander, didn't he wear a helmet or a combat fatigue? He wore the famous Eisenhower jacket.
Yeah, which he invented. I mean, I joked with his son John that it was flattering to him. That's why he invented it. But really, the larger point is here. He did not want to pretend. that he was a combat guy. I mean, some of these guys wore helmets and pistols and all that. Eisenhower, in his low-key, modest way, was making a statement, I'm not in combat. The other men are dying here. I'm not. And so he wore his normal uniform.
You have a story of Eisenhower and Patton touring a Nazi concentration camp outside of Gotha, Germany. How did each of them react?
Patton, when he saw it, threw up, vomited. Eisenhower went through this interesting moral thing. He ordered the mayor to clean up the mess, the townspeople and the mayor to clean it up. And this is a weird thing, a little bit hard to explain, but in the morning, the mayor and his wife hung themselves. And Eisenhower wrote, you know, at least they're, I don't remember the exact words, but there's some morality. They haven't totally gone numb. So it's hard to celebrate a suicide, but in this terrible, bizarre case, he did.
Did he have to be persuaded to run for president? He was president of Columbia University after the war.
He didn't have to be persuaded. I mean, there was a great ritual of trying to persuade him. And he would say, oh, no, I don't want to do that.
Well, he was being wooed by both parties.
Yes, by both parties. I mean, interesting little fact, Truman in 1946 asked him, President Truman asked General Eisenhower to run at the top of the ticket in 1948. Imagine this. The president of the United States agrees to be vice president so that General Eisenhower could run as a Democrat. Eisenhower rejected that, played hard to get, I think ultimately knew he'd have to run because he believed he was the guy for the job.
But were his politics so fluid that he could have been with either party, or was he naturally inclined to be a Republican?
He was naturally inclined. He was a balanced budget Republican, small government. But here's the important point. This is subtle. The Republicans in 1952 wanted to throw out the New Deal, a lot of them. They had a strong right wing called the Old Guard, and they didn't like Social Security and all that. Eisenhower importantly came in and said, no, no, we're going to keep the New Deal. We're going to keep the welfare state.
Although he fought against following the European model and instituting universal health, he called it socialized medicine.
He did. But he preserved the welfare state as it existed in 1952. He was not going to go further and create a European-type socialist state.
To some degree, Richard Nixon did the same sort of thing when he became president. Do you think that he was following Ike as a model?
Nixon's a hard one, too. Nixon liked to shoot people by surprise. And he brought in Pat Moynihan to be his domestic affairs guy. And Moynihan was full of brilliant ideas, many of them very progressive. And Nixon went along with it. I think he liked to be confound his enemies. I don't think it was so much that Ike was his model.
So Eisenhower was also taking over a party that had a strong isolationist wing, and he obviously was not an isolationist.
He was an internationalist. He was sort of comfortable at the Council on Foreign Relations and with that crowd. And he did not. He didn't believe you could go back to being Fortress America. We were, after World War II, we were it. We were the big power. And if anybody was going to stand up to communism, it was the United States.
How important was the fact that the Korean War was unpopular after we had been through World War II to his being elected?
Well, very important, because his most important moment in the 1952 campaign was when he announced, if elected, I will go to Korea. Now, he didn't know what he was going to do when he got there, but him simply saying that he was going to go there, newsmen listening to it said, hey, the election's over, he's won.
Because he was a respected general and people felt that he could figure it out.
Yeah, it's that simple.
Well, he did read On War by von Clausewitz three times.
He did. I mean, very important. Because people thought he was not an intellectual, just like middle-brow stuff. Not at all. He was deeply well-read. The ancient Greeks, Nietzsche, and Clausewitz. Now, Clausewitz, the important thing about Clausewitz to Ike is this. We think of this line that war is just politics by another means, that war is an extension of politics. That's not the meaning that Eisenhower got from Clausewitz. What he got from Clausewitz was small wars lead to big wars, and politicians who think they can control war are kidding themselves. This was the essential deeper meaning that Eisenhower drew from Clausewitz, and it informed him profoundly.
Well, the atom bomb ended the war, World War II. He had already completed his victory in Europe. But had he been consulted on any of the scientific research?
He was not. He was informed of it. He later claimed that he was against bombing Japan with an atom bomb. I think the record's a little blurry on that. He had some doubts about it, though.
Although the hydrogen bomb was developed under his watch.
He was briefed on it the day after he was elected. It wasn't developed under his watch. It was exploded the day he got into office.
He didn't like to use the word thermonuclear.
Well, he wanted to keep the public confused at first because the super bomb, as it was then called, was 500 times more powerful than the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. He thought it would scare the public. He changed his mind and decided, oh, my God, we have to tell the public about just how bad this is.
Do you think that the fact that he had witnessed this terrible war in Europe and then felt that way about the atom bomb was the reason that he had such an ambiguous relationship with the military-industrial complex?
Partly. I mean, true warriors have seen war. He wasn't in combat, but he saw a lot of battlefields. And he flew in a small plane from Berlin to Moscow in 1945 and saw not a single building left standing. The German and Russian armies had destroyed everything in their path. So Ike had a keen appreciation of how terrible war is. And he used nuclear weapons basically to keep us out of war, to bluff with them.
He mutually assured destruction is something that developed during his presidency?
Not by that label, but that was the effect of it. By the time he was done, you could tell that both sides could kill each other.
My guest is Evan Thomas. His latest book, Ike's Bluff, President Eisenhower's Secret Battle to Save the World. The way a lot of people remember Eisenhower is just how distracted or ill-informed he seemed at press conferences.
Yeah, a lot of that was fakery. His spoken syntax was weak, but his memos were clear as a bell. There's a famous scene I write about in the book, 1955. His advisors are saying, oh, you have to be careful, Mr. President, at this press conference. You're going to be asked these difficult questions. And Eisenhower said, oh, don't worry, I'll just confuse them. And he did. In fact, they joked afterwards the Kremlin translators must be having trouble figuring out what he was trying to say.
Well, he also had a reputation for going off playing golf when important things were happening.
Well, he teed off more than 800 times as president. I think only Woodrow Wilson played more. He played a lot of golf to calm himself. But a lot of this, again, was an illusion. He was right on top of things. He just gave the appearance of being out of it.
What about McCarthy? He could have slapped McCarthy down. He didn't.
He could have. And his own aides were really disappointed in him. You know, why aren't you standing up to McCarthy? And there's a famous scene in the 52 election where Ike pulls a sentence out of a speech denouncing McCarthy. And so there was a feeling of, you know, come on, Ike. But Eisenhower's response was, I'm not getting in the gutter with that guy. I'm not going to get into a pissing match with a skunk. And so his view was, let McCarthy hang himself. Now, it took a long time. It took a year and a half. But McCarthy did ultimately hang himself with some help from Eisenhower.
Eisenhower was not long in the White House when Stalin died. Was there a plan? Were they prepared for the post-Stalin Soviet Union?
This was shocking to Eisenhower. He said, you know, here it is, the head of this Soviet Empire dies and we have no plan. The CIA had no plan. We didn't know what was going on in the Soviet Union. We had no spies in there. We were clueless about the Soviet Union.
And they detonated their first atomic bomb when he was president.
Hydrogen bomb when he was president. Eisenhower could tell that both sides were now entering this age they called nuclear plenty, this kind of chilling word that means that either side could destroy the other.
So was he strong on defense? Did he believe that we should increase our military budget?
Here's a little known fact about Ike. He cut defense spending. Now, he cut it from a wartime high in Korea, but he was very careful about how he spent. He believed true national security came from a strong economy, and he was darned if he was going to let defense spending get out of control. In those days, defense spending was 60-70% of the entire federal budget. Today, it's less than 20%. That's where the money was. And Eisenhower is very conscious of not spending too much on defense.
On the other hand, many people consider it totally naive when he came up with the idea for atoms for peace.
Yes, but he was groping for some way to share, by sharing peaceful nuclear energy, to begin some kind of conversation with the Soviets. It didn't work, but it shows where his head was.
Well, my sense is that you feel that he was a kind of reluctant cold warrior. But John Foster Dulles was his Secretary of State. Nothing reluctant about him.
Yeah, but this is misleading. At the time, the press in the 1950s, the press was even lazier than they are today, if that's possible. And they thought that Dulles was running the show. He wasn't. He wasn't. It was a good cop, bad cop thing. Eisenhower was using Dulles to make the scary pronouncements. After the archives opened up, they found in Dulles' most famous speech, the massive retaliation speech, Ike's handwriting. He wrote that paragraph.
Well, we don't have a lot of time, but I want to address Vietnam and Cuba.
Yeah.
Some people feel that Eisenhower, and of course Iran, because he also was responsible for the toppling of Mossadegh and a couple of other countries in the world as well that got the CIA involved.
He over-relied on the CIA. This is a blotch on his record. But think about it. He wants to avoid conventional war. He wants to avoid nuclear war. What you going to do? Covert. Same issue that Barack Obama is facing right now on Iran, actually. And I can guarantee you that the CIA and the NSA are busy as we speak doing covert action. So this is, but Eisenhower over-relied on it. The CIA ultimately led him astray.
Well, it was in Guatemala as well, in Africa, and we overthrew the ruler of Vietnam, didn't we? Or
no?
Or was that under Kennedy?
That was under Kennedy. But your larger point that we were too busy doing that kind of stuff. And in retrospect, it looks not so wise.
And then we also, the Bay of Pigs planning was pretty much done under Eisenhower's watch, was it?
The idea of an exile army, but there's no way that Eisenhower would have approved the Bay of Pigs. In fact, Eisenhower and Kennedy met after the Bay of Pigs, and Eisenhower gave Kennedy a little lecture about how you plan for these things.
What about China? He thought Mao would be willing to go into thermonuclear war because he didn't mind losing a lot of soldiers?
Well, he worried about it because Mao made these outrageous statements. But he basically called Mao's bluff on Kimoi and Matsu, these islands long forgotten. But the fear was that the Red Chinese were going to invade Taiwan. Eisenhower basically bluffed with nuclear weapons and said, don't try us, and Mao backed off.
Was he stronger in foreign policy than he was in domestic policy?
Foreign policy was his main preoccupation. Saving the world was his main preoccupation.
So when there were squabbles in Congress, did he remain rather distant?
No. I mean, he worked with Southern Democrats. He was very bipartisan. He didn't like his own party that much. He worked with Southern Democrats, and they got stuff done. I mean, the highway system was done on his watch.
Mm-hmm. In fact, a lot of infrastructure was done under Eisenhower's watch.
In those days, there was money for infrastructure. It wasn't all yet going to social payments.
Well, the country was going through an incredible boom period. That must have helped him, and there was a feeling that that America was now the greatest country in the world, and we could do whatever we tried to do.
For better or worse, that was the feeling.
Evan Thomas is the author of the bestsellers, The War Lovers, Sea of Thunder, John Paul Jones, Robert Kennedy, The Very Best Men, The Man to See, and The Wise Men. His latest is Ike's Bluff, President Eisenhower's Secret Battle to Save the World. It is published by Little Brown. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks, Leonard.